The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com. Field Notes brand, makers of American memo books and more. Now featuring county fair editions, one for each state in the United States of America. Field Notes brand. I'm not writing it down to remember it later. I'm writing it down to remember it now. FieldNotesBrand.com. And by Smith Micro Software, makers of Stuff It Deluxe, designed to move files simply and securely wherever customers want them to go, for Mac and PC. Online at StuffIt.com. I'm Jesse Thorne, live on tape from my house in Los Angeles. It's the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. The Toronto International Film Festival is one of the largest film festivals in North America. It also has a reputation as a bit of a populist film festival. Everything plays here, from the arty art films to big Hollywood movies. That's why last month our friends Noel Murray and Scott Tobias headed out to Toronto to check out some of the movies that are expected to premiere this winter here in the United States. I spoke to them from Toronto late in the festival. Gentlemen, welcome to the Sound of Young America.
Thanks a lot, Jesse.
Thanks, yes.
So tell me about what makes Toronto different from, say, Cannes or Sundance or South by Southwest or some of these other film festivals that people might be familiar with.
Well, a couple of things. One is that it comes at the end of festival season, or near to the end anyway. It's way after Sundance, which is in January, and Cannes is in May. It's after Venice, just after Venice, and it's sort of a smorgasbord of world cinema. I mean, you have some premieres, particularly, award contending type of movies, and obviously other premieres. There's over 300 movies here, but it's really just kind of a nice sampling of all the festivals that come before us. So all the really good stuff from Sundance and Cannes and Venice ideally gets sort of filtered into this festival.
Yeah, it's called the Festival of Festivals.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. It is called the Festival of Festivals.
That's right. It's also, I think, a little bit more of a populist festival in that, unlike some other festivals where you really have to be a member of the press or a member of the industry to get in and see things, this is one where people can, film lovers from around the world can come here and get tickets and see just about anything they want to see.
Yeah, it's very democratic.
It also has a bit of a reputation as a little bit more populist in terms of its programming, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you have the Midnight Madness series, which has a lot of cult movies and genre pictures that are well liked. And there's, as Scott mentioned, this is kind of a kickoff to the Oscar season to a large degree. So every year you get eight or nine sort of middle browy movies that have great performances or more likely to end up on the year end award lists.
But it's almost kind of hard to pigeonhole too, because again, there are so many movies here. There were 300 movies, and then there's a huge avant garde section. There's movies of all stripes coming from around the world. So in that sense, I mean, yes, it's populous, and there are galas and stars and red carpets and that sort of thing. But there's a lot of range there.
Let's talk about some movies that you saw that there were very high expectations for going into the festival. We might as well start with The Illusionist. Folks might remember the animated film The Triplets of Belleville, which came out a few years ago and was Oscar nominated. Maybe it also won an Oscar. Tell me a little bit about this movie now that you've had a chance to take it in.
It's based on an unproduced screenplay by Jacques Tati, a French filmmaker who made these very kind of specific visual comedies. This is a film that he never got to make in his lifetime, and so the animator, who is a big Tati fan and actually had some Tati homages in Triplets of Belleville, adapted this thing into another animated film. It's about a magician who is kind of towards the end of his career. He's not as popular as he used to be. It's set in the early 60s. Rock and roll is sweeping the continent. And so he has one last tour of England and Scotland, and he meets somebody who believes that he actually is magic. And so he tries to persuade her that magic actually exists. It's a very, very sweet movie, very lyrical, very sad. I'm a huge fan of this film. I thought it was gorgeous. And I like the fact that it doesn't just pay homage to Tati, but it's also pays homage to Paolo Pressburger and Fellini and Max Ophuls and Jacques Demy and all these sort of filmmakers from that era who tried to do magical things with cinema. Scott's not quite as big.
I was not that big. I did like it, and his animation style, which is the sort of hand-drawn, very distinctive style. I mean, if you've seen Triplets of Belleville, I guess you know what to expect. It's very charming and warm, and homemade, and just it's really beautiful. And I think this film is, if anything, more beautiful than Triplets of Belleville. But I do feel like the whimsy in this film weighs heavy, and it felt like an extremely long 80 minutes to me. I think it didn't work quite as much for me as it did for Noel, but I really do look forward to seeing it again, just to sort of get lost in Chaumet's particular animated universe, which is quite stunning.
Let's take a really hard left turn away from whimsy. Darren Aronofsky, I remember when I first saw Pi, his first feature, and I saw him in like a weird screening room in Boston. My mom was doing like a summer student thing there. And I was really I was really overwhelmed by its depiction of migraine, which I get migraine headaches, and I was like, wow, that was really something. He has a new film coming out called Black Swan, which is about ballet. Tell me about it, and what were your impressions of having seen it?
It's quite good, and if I think, you know, how you feel about Aronofsky is going to determine quite a bit how you feel about this movie, because it's very much his. And you know, you mentioned, you know, the migraines in Pi. There is that physical, visceral quality to his films, and also this idea that of the of psychic stress showing on the body, which is a kind of a Cronenberg thing too. This is a movie starring Natalie Portman as a ballet dancer who gets the lead role in a new production of Swan Lake. And you know, in Swan Lake, you have to dance as the White Swan and the Black Swan, but she's very Natalie Portman-ish, so she can only really do the White Swan well because she lacks the spontaneity and passion to do Black Swan well. And this is the perfect role. And our friend Sam Adams, who's also a critic and a contributor to AV Club, he thinks that the movie is a comment on Natalie Portman herself because she is, you know, she is playing a character whose strengths and flaws are very similar to a lot of the strengths and flaws that people attribute to Natalie Portman, the actress. And I feel like this movie works those through brilliantly. It's the ideal role for her.
There's this new Michael Winterbottom film called The Trip. It has one of my favorite dudes around, Steve Coogan. Tell me a little bit about it. What did you think?
It's a very entertaining, very funny movie. I was a little disappointed in it because of the people involved. You know, Steve Coogan is very funny. The movie is basically him and Rob Brydon, an actor who's been in a lot of other British television shows, most notably Gavin and Stacey. And it's the two of them touring around the north of England, eating food and just talking.
Yeah.
And doing impressions.
Doing a lot of impressions.
And competing with each other. We didn't realize this until after it was over, but apparently this is actually going to be a 6-part TV series in the UK. And they turned it into a hour and 40-minute.
More than that. It's an hour and 50.
Yeah, hour and 50 feature film. And it's quite choppy, quite frankly. And there are points where it seems to cut away too soon. There are things that seem very repetitive that might not seem repetitive if you saw them week to week on a TV show. So, but that said, it's, you know, the relationship between these two guys. I mean, they're playing quote unquote themselves. Steve Coogan as a guy whose career is not going where as well as he wanted it to go, and Rob Brydon is a guy who's very happy with his kind of middle of the road career. So the two of them talk about that. They talk about being middle aged. They talk about, you know, various pop culture things, and they see who does the best Michael Caine impression.
And they get on each other's nerves quite a bit too. The Michael Caine, there's just an unbelievably brilliant scene early on where they not only do a Michael Caine impressions, but they do impressions that evolve, that show how Michael Caine's voice has evolved over time, and it's amazing.
It's funny to think. I mean, I think Coogan's career has in many ways traced his development from an impressionist, which is what he was when he broke into the comedy scene in England, into this sort of epic character, comedy character actor. It's funny to think that now he's playing himself. He's playing himself doing impressions.
Yeah, and you know, he's kind of gotten to a point where he's constantly playing himself in movies, it seems. He's playing a guy who is not quite as happy with his career as he wanted to be. He's basically playing Alan Partridge as Steve Coogan. Which is, you know, a weird kind of through the glass kind of meta thing here
that are hard to contemplate.
What were some of the movies that you had high hopes for that didn't meet them?
One film I had really high expectations for that didn't meet them is It's Kind of a Funny Story, which is a new film from Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden, who are the directors of Half Nelson and Sugar, two dramas I enjoyed quite a bit. And this is a change of pace for them. It's a comedy with dramatic elements about a young, teenaged, pretty privileged kid who nonetheless has thoughts of suicide and gets checked into a psych ward. And the psych ward is filled with a lot of kind of wacky characters, you know, the most prominent of whom is played by Zach Galifianakis, who I love in the movie, the one sort of big saving grace for me. But it's one of those things where it's trying to mix comedy and drama. It's trying to have these really broad laughs in it, but then also take mental illness and you know, psychological trauma seriously, and it's very hard to pull that off. And I think that the pacing of the film is too slow. The laughs really aren't there much of the time, and the shift in tone doesn't really work. So that was a kind of a tough one for me.
Well, I'm sad to hear that. In addition to Zach Galifianakis, a favorite past Sound of Young America guest, isn't Jim Gaffigan in that one as well?
Very small role as the kid's father.
For me, I think it would be 127 Hours, the new Danny Boyle film, which stars James Franco as a guy who is sort of an outdoor adventure-y type. It's based on a true story about this guy. He's an outdoor adventure-y type who is out in the Utah desert and is jumping through cliffs and canyons, and a large boulder falls on his arm, and he is stuck with that boulder on his arm for 127 hours, which is about 5 days. And it kind of goes through his, you know, his different ways that he's trying to get free from this boulder, and his kind of reflecting on his life and what this moment means and what he needs to do about his life if he ever does get free. And then, you know, ultimately it deals with his escape and how that, you know, what happens afterward. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Danny Boyle. I didn't like Slumdog Millionaire very much. I think his big problem as a filmmaker is that he's really into viscerally exciting things. So he's constantly trying to make movies that distract the audience and kind of amuse the audience, but they don't always necessarily give the audience what they really need. And so for this story, I did like it, and I did think that James Franco was terrific, and it's got a terrific beginning, and the ending is very exciting. But there are times in the middle where he's trying to, you know, keep you entertained with a guy with a rock on his arm, and maybe he didn't need to do that. Maybe he needed to actually make you feel what it's like to have a rock on your arm a little bit more. So that's one that that other people really, really love, and I'm just kind of meh on.
What about movies that disappointed you that you may not have had as high expectations for?
What about the junk, Noel?
What about what?
What about the pure garbage? You have some of that. You had the Will Ferrell movie.
Yeah, I did see a Will Ferrell movie called Everything Must Go, which is based on a Raymond Carver short story in which Ferrell plays a guy who gets laid off from his job, comes home and finds out that his wife has put all of his personal belongings on the yard. So he decides to live on the lawn and sell his stuff, which is a great idea for a movie. But the problem is that this is total indie mush. It's got the plunky guitar soundtrack. It's got the kind of, you know, little dramedy beats that are, you know, wry but not really all that funny. It's the kind of thing really that would have been better if it had been a Will Ferrell movie, you know, if it had been actually kind of riotous and bizarre and strange and not kind of earnest.
It's always tough when you're – I mean, I couldn't be a bigger Will Ferrell fan. I really think he's a brilliant genius. But, you know, I didn't really care for Stranger Than Fiction either. It's kind of hard to know what to do when your character's greatest qualities are about earnestness. Earnestness in the service of earnestness can be a little bit too much.
Yeah, I think people make the mistake sometimes. When, you know, comedians, when they're trying to go dramatic, they just maybe go too far. You know, and this is actually somewhat of a, you know, it's a dramedy. So he is trying to be funny at times. But
Stranger Than Fiction was that way as well. And I think you kind of want to root for actors to sort of break out of, to do things outside of the mainstream and to make that work for them. The Stranger Than Fiction worked a little bit better for me, I think, than you, Jesse. But this one sounded pretty bad.
Noel Murray and Scott Tobias of the AV Club
They're online at avclub.com. We spoke while they were visiting the Toronto International Film Festival last month. Our special thanks to Chris Berube of CIUT in Toronto, who helped us record that interview. And by the way, we had one day of the film festival left when we recorded this interview. And 2 days after we recorded it, I got an email from Scott Tobias. He said, "Hey, Jesse, just wanted to let you know that our line about the middling quality of this year's Toronto International Film Festival has changed a bit since we recorded the show. Specifically, I had one of the best movie-going days of my life today." So Scott would like to strongly recommend the terrific, in his words, Errol Morris documentary Tabloid, the Takashi Miike samurai movie 13 Assassins, and a movie called Meek's Cutoff by Kelly Reichardt, which he described as maybe the best movie I've seen in the 17 years I've been reviewing movies. I felt like that was a worthy coda to our interview. So check out Tabloid and 13 Assassins and Meek's Cutoff when they hit theaters in the United States. The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.